Thank you for listening to Rearview Mirror Chronicles. To send me an email, please use rearviewmirrorchronicles@gmail.com. And to send me a message on WhatsApp, +60 16 425 6301. At length the air began to grow grey with light, and swift golden arrows came flashing across the snow. And at last the glorious sun peeped up from the lava wall and looked in upon our half-frozen forms, and upon Vent Fergal sitting there amongst us, stone dead. No wonder his back had felt cold, poor fellow. He had died when I'd heard him sigh, and was now almost frozen stiff. Shocked beyond measure, we dragged ourselves from the corpse. Strange the horror we all have of the companionship of a dead body, and left it sitting there with its arms clasped around its knees. By this time the sunlight was pouring its cold rays, for here they were cold, straight in at the mouth of the cave. Suddenly I heard an exclamation of fear from someone and turned my head down the cave, and this is what I saw. Sitting at the end of it, for it was not more than 20 feet long, was another form of which the head rested on the chest and the long arms hung down. I stared at it and saw that it too was a dead man, and what's more, a white man. That is the absolutely thrilling moment from King Solomon's Mines, which was published in 1885. It was written by Henry Rider Haggard. What a name. I mean, what a great name for an author. And even if you've never read it, you will be familiar with it because it is one of the best-selling novels of the Victorian age. And it continues to sell in bucket loads even now. And it's massively, massively influential on everything from Tolkien to Indiana Jones and practically every film where that scene has been played and replayed. King Solomon's Mines, it's not just an enormously influential kind of text of empire, of the British Empire, and of Britain's involvement in Africa, but I would actually argue it's a foundational text of modern popular culture. Indiana Jones films could not have been written without it, and I would argue Tomb Raider as well. And if you've ever played Tomb Raider or Uncharted, the video games, or if your children have played those games, they're playing versions of King Solomon's Mines. It's enormously important. So let me just give you an outline of the plot of King Solomon's Mines. It's basically a quest plot set in Africa in late 19th century Africa. Our hero is Alan Quatermain, and I'll go on to talk about him later. But effectively, he's a hunter, he's an explorer, he's an adventurer, and he teams up with this sort of fellowship, I guess, just like what Tolkien writes about some 50 years later. And they set off on this extraordinary, fantastical landscape into uncharted Africa. They trek over an incredibly parched desert and they arrive at this mountain. And that's where the scene of the cave with the frozen white man comes in that I read to you at the beginning of this podcast. And what they're doing is they're heading into the blank spaces of the map on Africa. And that's, again, it's something I'll come back to a little bit later. And they're in search of King Solomon's treasure mines. They believe that there's treasure, an enormous amount of treasure buried there. And there's also kind of two other quests in the story. They're kind of overlapping quests, if you like. But just like, they're very familiar, kind of more modern quest stories that you'll become acquainted with. So one of the fellowship is looking for his brother, who's gone missing, and another one of their party is in disguise. He may or may not be the lost king of a lost kingdom. So all of this is very exciting, and they go on all these adventures. They find this incredible lost kingdom and this terribly wicked and formidable supervillain who's the king of it, you know, who they fight, of course. And there's an incredibly sinister witch called Gagool, who I'll also talk about a little bit later. They also discover the mines and they discover the caves. And of course, they go down into the caves and they get trapped in the caves. And there's all sorts of adventures and terrors and threats down there in those caves. And would you believe it? Spoiler alert, they emerge triumphant at the end of the story. And look, I don't think I'm giving away the plot by telling anyone that if you haven't read the book. I read the book when I was at school. And I saw the movie in 1985, the first movie that was to come out about it, which was a terrible movie, I have to say, with Richard Chamberlain as Alan Quatermain. He should never have been cast in that role. It was one of the worst casts, I think, of 1985. And there was also a terrible miniseries that came out in 2004. And look, none of these adaptations actually do the book any justice whatsoever. One thing that struck me as I read the book is that it has the primal theme of white explorers arriving in Africa and, you know, impressing the natives with their knowledge of, you know, things like eclipses of the sun and eclipses of the moon. And that's become such a familiar trope, hasn't it? But not then. But, you know, now it appears in so many adventure stories. But I checked, and this is actually the first time that it's ever been used in a book, 1885. And that gives an indication of how important this book actually is. I mean, it's an absolutely massive cliche breeder, isn't it? In fact, when you read King Solomon's Mines now, almost every chapter is stacked full of stereotypes and cliches, but that's because this is the first book of its type. It's never been written about before. So the scenes of going into the caves and discovering the dead bodies, and of course, we've all seen it, you know, 1,000 times in Hollywood movies. It's King Solomon's Mines, the book, that creates all of that. But of course, there are a lot more cliches that are bred of the, you know, of the imperial age that will seem offensive now, but not then. And of course, I'll talk about that a little bit later, too. So, H. Rider Haggard, or Rider Haggard as he was known, who is he? Well, Henry Rider Haggard is a child of the Empire. And for those younger listeners, that's not the Empire in Star Wars. No, no. He's someone who goes to seek his fortune in what was then the massive British Empire, when the British were the most powerful nation on Earth. I know, hard to imagine now. So he's the 8th out of 10 children born to William Haggard, who actually claims descent from a Danish lord. And at this stage, they're a family of squires, a man of high social standing. And what's interesting about Haggard, not unlike his greatest fan, who is J.R.R. Tolkien, there are a lot of similarities in the Lord of the Rings story, and Tolkien is a massive, massive fan of Haggard. Haggard, like Tolkien, has a great sense of loss and nostalgia, and he's backwards looking, and his family owns a lot of land in rural England, but what changes in their world is free trade. Cheap imported food and labor from Europe means that their privileged world is embattled. Haggard was initially sent to Garingston Rectory in Oxfordshire, but unlike his elder brothers, who graduated from various private schools, he attended Ipswich Grammar School. And this was largely because his father said that he wouldn't amount to much and would probably end up as a greengrocer. So Haggard, after failing his army entrance exam, he was sent to a private crammer in London to prepare for, the entrance exams for the British Foreign Office, which he never actually sat. And of course, Haggard would go on to prove his father very, very wrong. But his childhood, you can see that it's a breeding ground for a lot that he actually writes about later in his life. You know, as a child, he, even though he wasn't his father's favorite, he was very keen on hunting, which was encouraged. He loved fishing and shooting and, you know, all that kind of stuff, all the kind of stuff that was going to build him for, you know, an amazing life, a future life in Africa. And what's amazing is that he had this really very sinister rag doll that he actually called She Who Must Be Obeyed. And of course, we've all heard that phrase as well in various different sitcoms and movies. And his nurse actually used the doll to menace him into doing what she wanted. And of course, that all becomes very much a part, an important part of Haggard's writing later on. So in 1875, he's 19 years old, and his father discovers a family friend who lives very nearby, Sir Henry Bulwer, is actually going out to South Africa to become the Lieutenant Governor of Natal, which is a province, a British province in South Africa at the time. So he actually writes to him. I laugh, but I can imagine this conversation taking place. But he actually says something to the akin to, I've got this, you know, absolutely useless son that I can't do anything with. You know, can you take him with you and whip him into something more manly, you know, more useful? But clearly, Haggard isn't as useless. He's not as useless as his father thinks he is, because he ends up writing two of the best-selling books that have ever been written. So Sir Henry agrees that Ryder can go with him, and basically he is Sir Henry's dog's body, and he does his bidding. He's basically his PA, and he organizes his banquets and his travel and his servants. And in his spare time, he hunts on the vast African velds. He goes out by himself, and he actually ends up falling completely in love with Africa and with the feeling that there is a sense of adventure where this is a place where a man can do what he likes without being controlled by Big Brother. And of course, he quickly becomes a great admirer of the Zulus, and he sees in the Zulus a warrior class in the same ilk as the Vikings, or even as the older Spartans, and he's very much impressed by them. I have to say, folks, my parents actually lived in Africa as well. We lived in East Africa for a while, actually, in Nairobi, and then on a diamond mine in Tanzania, and it was very isolated. And I have to say, if you've never been to Africa, go. There is a feeling there as the sun rises that's unlike anywhere else that I've ever visited in the world. It's primal, it's exciting, and you know you're in the most amazing land. And I understand absolutely where Haggard was coming from. So, give you a bit of history. At this stage, the British are actually expanding from South Africa, and they're expanding north, you know, further into Boer territory, effectively chasing gold and diamonds. And there's absolutely no argument with regards to this. That's exactly what they're doing. They wanted what the Boers had, and it was an all-out land grab. And of course, this led to confrontations with not only the Boers, but also the tribes that they encountered along the way. And of course, the Zulus were one of those tribes that were standing steadfastly in their way. So in 1876, Ryder goes to Bulawayo, which is the Zulu capital, and he sees a war dance, a Zulu war dance, for the first time, and he writes about it. And he writes this: it was like coming face to face with primeval nature, not as we civilized people know her, with smiling cornfields waving at well-ordered woods, but nature that she was on the morrow of creation. And that actually tells you something of the British attitude to Africa and Ryder Haggard himself. You know, that it's primeval, that it's unspoiled by modernity, that somehow it's also, I think, truer, cleaner, and more authentic, but that it was also a lot more. And I hate to use the word, but Haggard would have said that it was definitely more savage. But I also think that he would have thought that there was a pristine kind of warrior potency, and that potency had been extinguished in Great Britain. But you know what? Among the Zulus, it still existed, and that it also hadn't really changed since the beginning of time. And there's an amazing detail that I'll comment on. So Britain goes to war with Zulus, and I covered this in some detail in my Cecil Rhodes podcast kind of mid last year. And if you're interested in South Africa and Cecil Rhodes, you should go and listen to it, because there's a lot of information there that will kind of give you the color of what was happening at this particular moment in time in Africa. And what happens at this stage is that the British get wiped out at Isandhlwana. And there is a heroic defense a little bit later by British soldiers at Rorke's Drift, which was actually covered in the movie Zulu. If you haven't seen that movie, oh my gosh, go and watch that movie. It's an incredible movie with Michael Caine. A great movie. And Rider Haggard actually visits the battlefield at Isandhwana. And keep in mind that over 1,300 British troops were massacred there by the Zulus. And Haggard goes there for the first time, and he reports seeing crushed cartridge cases and a broken cricket stump and ball. And this tells you something of the massacre, of what the British were doing at that particular moment in time. They weren't ready for the Zulus, and the Zulus wiped them out to a man. And there is something there that you also get with, you know, Rudyard Kipling, who actually despises, you know, kind of muddy loafers and flannelled fools, that the British are in some way unserious as warriors compared to the Zulus, and that the only reason that the British win at Rorke's Drift, which is the Zulu film, the Welsh victory effectively, is because they have Gatling guns. And one of the things that Haggard loves about Africa is the romance and the possibility of exploration. You know, think of the movie Out of Africa. But that the actual empire, the British Empire, I think he views it with some disappointment. And we see this coming across in his books. Haggard eventually leaves the employ of Sir Henry and marries, and he starts, of all things, an ostrich farm, which he actually loves, by the way. But tensions are still very high. And at one stage, he actually reports hearing a battle in the distance. So the British, again, battling with either the Boers or the Zulus, again, in which the British are defeated. I mean, these are small numbers, by the way, but all the same, they're taking these small defeats. Haggard eventually comes back to England. He's been in Africa at this stage 5 years. Gladstone is now Prime Minister, and he's a lot less warmongering than his previous counterpart, Disraeli. And this is effectively the end of Rider Haggard in Africa. He never goes back. He becomes a lawyer, he's called to the bar, and he decides that he will become a writer, something that he's been passionate about for a long time. And he starts writes two pretty useless books. And then he comes across an amazing story. He's on the train one day to London with one of his brothers, and they're talking about a book that has been a major hit, and it's the first one of its genre. And that book, one of my favorites as a child, is Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, published in 1883. And it was an absolutely enormous hit in the United Kingdom, and of course then America, and it actually appealed to an entirely new readership. Keep in mind, up until this time, the people who were reading books were middle class to wealthy. But you're entering a time where, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, where you're talking about cheap labor and cheap resources, and people who are actually newly literate, largely due to the Education Service and the Education Act of 1870, which expanded schooling throughout Britain. And this makes all the difference, because a generation or two earlier, they wouldn't have been able to read or write. And of course, none of these books would have had any kind of impact whatsoever. So books are actually cheaper, they're affordable, newspapers are new, and the British public can't get enough of this new genre. You know, derring do and blood and thunder and all that kind of thing, which is exactly what, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson's book was about. Absolutely love it. So Treasure Island is about a world that is more exotic. It's more dangerous. It's got pirates, it's got treasure, it's got adventure. You know, it's pure escapism. And it's rooted in a kind of fantastical version of history, I suppose. But, you know, that's hard for us to imagine in this particular day and age. But the best bit about Treasure Island is that it opens up with a map. I absolutely love that. I love maps. So anyway, Rider Haggard says to his brother, "I think I could write something like this. I don't think Robert Louis Stevenson is that great." I mean, can you imagine? And his brother says, "I bet you 5 shillings you can't do it as well as Robert Louis Stevenson." And Haggard says, "You're on. I'll do it." Now, what would have happened had they not had that bet? Now, Haggard says that it actually takes him exactly 6 weeks to write King Solomon's Mines. But authors, and keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, I am an author and I can vouch for this, we're always saying that. But I do think that Haggard wrote it very fast. And I think he was worried that someone was actually going to beat him to it. And you can actually tell that he wrote it fast because of the writing and the grammar that he uses. And I think that's a fair assessment that he wouldn't be too upset with if he was sitting opposite me today. So he writes King Solomon's Mines, which is his own quest story set in the heart of Africa, where he had just spent 5 years. And that's the key thing. He's actually saying in the novel that there are unknown reaches, but that's actually not quite true. He actually knows full well that there aren't those undiscovered, you know, deserts or any possibility whatsoever of a lost paradise or a lost kingdom, you know, or deep caves and mountains that, you know, are hoarding vast amounts of gold and diamonds. So what he does, like every great writer, he invents. And he invents Kaoana Land. And in Kaoana Land, it's more beautiful than anywhere else on Earth. It's more intense and it's more glamorous and it's more exciting. And the warriors there are braver and the women are more beautiful. And, you know, it's a fantastical land. But think of the times. This is so exciting. But of course, he knows full well that it doesn't exist. However, the thing that really puts the publishers off King Solomon's Mines is the violence. It's a very violent book for its time. And there's a particular scene in the book where a young Zulu boy is actually torn apart by elephants. But as it turns out, and I love this, most children actually love violence in books. And anyone who has written a children's book knows that this is true. But one publisher said, "Nothing in the hands of one so young is likely to do more injury than this immoral book." So actually, lots of publishers turned it down. But what they're doing is creating a myth around the book. And now suddenly, everybody wants to read it. Everybody is waiting for this book to come out. And then Castle actually agrees to publish it. They see the value. They hear the hype. And the note here to all aspiring authors is never give up. As a footnote, my first book, which I wrote in 2003, was turned down by no less than 39 publishers before HarperCollins actually saw value in it and said yes. And I'm telling you this only because I want to give you hope. Keep on going. If you're a writer, and gosh, I hope this inspires people to write, but if you've got a book in you, and I think everybody has a book in you, write it, because there will be someone out there who will like that book. And of course, guys, don't forget, Harry Potter was actually turned down by everyone as well. Back to Haggard. In the autumn of 1885, King Solomon's Mines is finally released, and they prompt the release with billboards all over London with headlines that it's the most amazing book ever written. I mean, as an author, you couldn't ask for more. And it's a massive, massive hit, not least because this is the year of the Berlin Conference, with all the European colonial powers actually meeting to divide Africa up between themselves. Give that some thought. They're dividing Africa up between themselves. And of course, this is the onset of the scramble for Africa. And the book actually gets brilliant reviews, by and large, and magazines like The Athenaeum say, you know, the fighting scenes were hardly to be beaten outside Homer. I mean, that's an incredible statement. And again, when you mention Homer, you think of the primal warrior virtue at the beginning of time. And of course, this is what Haggard sees with the Zulus. Now, funnily enough, Robert Louis Stevenson, whom Haggard had, you know, kind of disparaged and actually made a bet with his brother to beat, he actually writes to Haggard and he says, "Well done, tremendous book. What an amazingly fine, weird imagination you have." But he also says to Haggard, and I love this, "Just be careful with your prose. You should slow down a bit," which Haggard found incredibly condescending and ignored, because over the next few months, he actually poured his energy into more books and produces a sequel called Alan Quatermain and another book that he titled She, which I'll come to a little bit later. This is an absolutely foundational text of the popular imagination. So Haggard gives up becoming a lawyer. He becomes a full-time writer and he makes boatloads of money and he buys massive estates in the country. And as you do, and of course, he tries his hand in politics by becoming a Tory politician. He actually stands in Norfolk in 1895. And I laugh because he loses, which is really strange. But Haggard says that, you know, the area was very unfriendly to his cause. The actual fact was that he just moved there. He didn't know the locals. He bought this massive estate and the locals were probably wondering, you know, who the hell is this? And what the hell is he doing in our county? And of course, imported food was very cheap at this stage. And he was in an agricultural area who were finding things pretty tough. So a wealthy guy moving in with, you know, absolutely bags of cash, it was probably something that they really couldn't relate to. But he then becomes a famous kind of Africanist. So he's the head of all kinds of commissions and panels, even though I mentioned he was only there 5 years. And he writes an entire Zulu trilogy. And this, of course, features Allan Quatermain again, featuring, you know, Zakali, the dwarf wizard known as the thing that should never have been born. You know, which is just fantastic. I mean, I'd love his imagination. And then, of course, you know, his trajectory is a little bit predictable. So by the 1910s, he spends all his time basically talking about radicals, as the entire world does, and Bolsheviks and, you know, international socialism and all that kind of stuff, because it was basically what you talked about. I mean, I can only imagine what he would have been putting out there had he had the internet. I mean, I think it's fair to say that he probably would have been cancelled. I think it's also fair to say that King Solomon's Mines and She would have actually been a bit like the Star Wars of today. Every reading person in the world would have been aware of those two books and, of course, the Allan Quatermain character and of the cliches and you know, all the tropes. Effectively, people coming from the civilized world suddenly being able to reach the far ends of the earth. Going back to the book, I remember reading it for the first time as an adult and thinking, what are King Solomon's Mines doing in darkest Africa? I mean, it's a long way from Jerusalem. I mean, Indiana Jones comes to mind, and the idea that there are lost civilizations waiting to be discovered, you know, places like Atlantis. You know, I mean, effectively, that's what keeps us all going, doesn't it? And the idea that there are ruins and ancient civilizations in Africa waiting to be discovered, and that they're not African, but they've actually been built by outsiders, or that they've been built by, you know, mysterious powers, or that they harbor, you know, secret technologies, you know, within them. And in this case, it's the idea that Solomon and the Venetians are working together. They're actually working to build this temple, and that they go to a place called Ophir. And basically, in King Solomon's Mines, Ophir is identified as Kwanaland. I know. And in the Bible, which I covered in an earlier podcast as well, it actually says that Solomon received gold, cedarwood, peacocks, and lots of other general stuff from this place that has never actually been pinned down, this secret place that no one's ever actually been able to find. And people all the way through the medieval period have always been fascinated by the idea that there was some kind of lost kingdom out there in Africa, which was the real Ophir, and that this place, wherever it may be in Africa, it must be incredibly rich. Well, it would have to be. And that sort of became conflated with the other idea that there was this lost Christian king out there called Prester John. And I started to hear that tale when I was at school. And this was tangled up with some garbled tale. I think I'm right by saying Abyssinia. But there was also another Solomonic element too. And that was about the Queen of Sheba. We've all heard that story too, right? And of course, everyone knew where she was. She was in southern Arabia somewhere. But in the Middle Ages, people weren't satisfied with that because it was almost too obvious. you know, basically Europeans started talking about Africa because it was unknown. There were massive blank spaces on the map. It was unmapped effectively at that stage. So people start thinking that Prester John and Ophir and Sheba are now somehow kind of blended together, and they are to be found in the depths of darkest Africa. And look, these stories go all the way back to the 16th century, you know, when the Portuguese start going upriver, and, you know, they're actually the first Europeans to do so. So in 1552, there was this guy called Abaros who wrote a whole book where he conflates Prester John and the Queen of Sheba and actually says that there's a mysterious city in the middle of Africa, like he came across it. And this proves to be an amazingly potent idea, because the reality is there actually was. And over the centuries that follow, people keep looking for it based on what he wrote. For Rider Haggard, the key thing is that in 1871, an explorer that I guess no one would have ever heard of by the name of Karl, I'm just trying to think how you say his name, he's German. I think it's Mulcht. M-O-U-L-C-H, Mulcht. He actually discovers a spectacular ruined city. And this is the thing, you know, people have actually been talking about a ruined city in the middle of Africa for hundreds of years. And what do you know? There it is. And of course, this is Great Zimbabwe. And I think there was another German explorer who actually discovered it a few years before Mulcht, before he popularized it. Anyway, this all happens a decade or so before, you know, Rider Haggard actually writes King Solomon's Mines. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just read you what Mulcht says about what he discovers there. Now, keep in mind that, and I give you a pre-warning, keep in mind he's an abstainer. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs, but he is an archaeologist. Anyway, here we go. This is what he says verbatim. It can be taken as fact that the wood that we obtained from Great Zimbabwe is actually cedar wood, and it absolutely cannot come from anywhere else other than from the Lebanon. Furthermore, only the Venetians could have brought it here. That's right, folks. You don't have to rewind. I did say the Venetians. So that's the level of evidence. And of course, people now read this and think, oh my gosh, you know, this is pure imperialism. You know, European observers could simply not get their heads around the idea that people in what is now the country of Zimbabwe could have actually built a medieval city. It was impossible. They just couldn't do it. They didn't think that Africans were capable of it. So they had to kind of invent all these ideas that people, white people, had traveled enormous distances in a time where these places were completely inaccessible and established Venetian colonies in South Africa or wherever. And it's clearly founded on the idea that Africans can't produce their own civilizations. But it's also expressive, I think, of a desire for Europeans to join this exotic land of adventure. And things like this, I think, gives them reference points that they can understand. Anyway, in King Solomon's Mines, the Hermeric, there's a great war that is fought in Kakwana land, and it's described in very hermetic terms, the Viking. So one of the heroes in King Solomon's Mines, like Rider Haggard himself, is of Viking descent, Sir Henry. And he's often described with, you know, big hair and a big beard. You know, you can imagine the series Vikings. Think about the biggest, hairiest guy that you can see, and this is Sir Henry. And, you know, he's got bulging arm muscles, you know, biceps that can crack a walnut. And there is enormous enthusiasm in Haggard's descriptions of the physical, which is so very much of its time. So Sir Henry Curtis joins up with the Zulu guy, you know, who I mentioned at the beginning, who's been accompanying them as a servant. But of course, he's not. And it turns out that he's actually the rightful king of Kakwana land. And his name is Ignosi. And he's effectively the Aragorn, you know, from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And he and Sir Henry, you know, they get naked. They dress up in Zulu war gear. You know, they oil themselves or they oil each other. And of course, Rider Haggard had this to say about it. The dress was no doubt a savage one, but I had never seen a finer sight than Sir Henry in this guise. It showed off his physical physique to the greatest advantage. Arms like boulders. And then Ignosi arrived shortly in a similar costume. I thought that you were never again to see such two splendid specimens of men. I mean, we could go deep on this, but I don't think there's any need to. I mean, there are a lot of things that come to mind, aren't there? But Haggard actually thinks that Ignosi is part of the cultural level, or on the same cultural level with the Vikings and the Spartans. And Sir Henry Curtis is, by going there, has effectively claimed his own status in a way that he would never have done had he stayed on his ancestral estate in England. And this is a really important point. You know, he has this idea, and I think it's enormously potent. And actually, you can actually see it in all sorts of popular culture today. This idea that by going to Africa, one has somehow turned the clock back and cast off the degeneracy of life and become cleansed or wholly authentic. So going back to Haggard and Great Zimbabwe, he wrote the preface to a history of Great Zimbabwe of this site. He absolutely believed 100% that it was Venetian. I mean, what a completely bonkers idea. But for Haggard, he then wonders what it could be. And what he wants is for it in centuries to come is a city that will once more nestle, you know, in these gray and ancient ruins, trading in gold as it had when it was established by the Venetians. And of course, it's going to be ruled in the future by men of the Anglo-Saxon race. And in fact, that does happen, actually, because in 1890, the region where Great Zimbabwe stands, which has since been named Mashonaland, is actually occupied by none other than Cecil Rhodes and his South Africa company. And Rhodes actually becomes obsessed by the idea that Great Zimbabwe was Venetian, and he actually sets up a company called Rhodesia Ancient Ruins Limited. I kid you not. Which claimed the exclusive tourist rights to Great Zimbabwe. So it actually does, you know, Haggard's forecast actually does come to fruition. As I said, I actually did a podcast on Cecil Rhodes not that long ago. But if you didn't listen to that particular podcast, because Rhodes may not be your cup of tea, Mashonaland actually becomes Rhodesia, which is named after Cecil Rhodes, and becomes a white settler country. And of course, as I just said, you know, Haggard in some ways actually got what he wanted, because they did find gold there and they found diamonds there. And of course, this is what was driving the British deeper and deeper into southern Africa. And let's just take a short break for a message from our sponsor. Alter Domus is your one-stop shop for your Malaysia My Second Home visa. But they are much more than that. When you sign up with Alter Domus, you become part of a larger community, a community that cares about you in Malaysia. And that's important when you move to a new home. So for more information, call Alter Domus or WhatsApp them on +60 12 493 7270 or visit their website www.penangmyhome.com. And we are back. And for any female listeners who are feeling that this is all a bit masculine, oily and masculine, maybe I should have a chat about Haggard's attempt to talk about women. And for that, I'll start by giving you a direct quote from she. There, not more than 40 or 50 miles from us, glistening like silver in the early rays of the morning sun, soared Sheba's breasts. And stretching away for hundreds of miles on either side of them ran the great Suleiman Berg. Now that I, sitting here, attempt to describe the extraordinary grandeur and beauty of that sight, language seems to fail me. I am impotent even before its memory. There, straight before us, rose two enormous mountains, the like of which are not, I believe, to be seen anywhere else in Africa, if indeed there are any such in the world. Measuring on each of them at least 15,000 feet in height, standing not more than a dozen miles apart, linked together by a precipitous cliff of rock, and towering in awful white solemnity straight into the sky. These mountains placed thus, like the pillars of a gigantic gateway, are shaped after the fashion of a woman's breasts, and at times the mists and shadows beneath them take the form of a recumbent woman, veiled mysteriously in sleep. Their bases swell gently from the plain, looking at that distance perfectly round and smooth, and upon the top of each is a vast hillock covered with snow, exactly corresponding to the nipple on the female breast. Deep waters indeed. I have to say, that's a very strange passage. And the weird thing is that Haggard actually makes a boast when asked about the book that there are no petticoats in King Solomon's mines. And even in the introduction, he actually dedicates it to all the big and little boys who read it. So clearly, the female isn't at the forefront of Haggard's mind. And yet, actually, there is actually a... I think there's a nervousness about the female throughout the book. And I know I'm going into some very deep waters here with some of my listeners. But bear with me. There's a couple of things here. One is that Haggard, like so many imperial writers of his day, is absolutely obsessed with the idea of the masculine brotherhood and manliness. He absolutely believes that you will become more manly by going to Africa. As he did, I suppose. But more importantly, your manliness has to be connected to other men. Critics actually described it at the time as homosocial rather than homoerotic. And I'm not too sure whether homoerotic actually existed at that particular time. So I see it as homoerotic, but it was actually described as homosocial. But the way he actually talks about Sir Henry, you know, in the book, you know, rippling muscles and all that kind of thing, there is an awful lot going on there when you read between those lines. And that is actually very common at this time, with not just writers, but also, you know, all the real life kind of imperial characters at the time, real life imperial characters at the time, like, you know, General Gordon of Khartoum, who I spoke about on There's Always Tea in one of the podcasts there. And of course, Lord Milner, you know, etc. It was all about strapping young men, stripping off together, bathing together, and all that kind of stuff. But you get the impression that there is a certain nervousness about women in general, not just from Haggard, but every other writer of this generation. And look, I don't think you have to be Sigmund Freud to realize that the entire journey, you know, this entire trip across Africa, Africa is actually represented as the female body. You know, Haggard describes her breasts. I mean, literally. And I know he's talking about the Queen of Sheba's breasts, but we're talking about Africa. And then the fellowship go into this, you know, beautiful, lush, paradisical land. And then, of course, they go deep underground in tunnels and they get trapped there and they can't get out. And they get trapped there by the most memorable character in the entire book, which is a female called Gagool, who is absolutely fabulously ancient. I absolutely love her. And Haggard in the book is also obsessed with monkeys, and he actually describes Gagool as a monkey. And he, and of course, people who are also in the book who were so old, you know, the ancients in the book, he also describes as ancient monkeys. And future writers copy this theme. I mean, I believe 100% that Gagool is Gollum in The Lord of the Rings. Hands down. You know, she capers around like a monkey, like Gollum does. She is wizened and wrinkled like Gollum. And it's as though that by living so long, she has almost become stretched and degenerated and parched into something that's not quite human. And it rings bells, of course. Now, obviously, there are all kinds of things that are going on here. She's a woman. She's black. She's African. And I think there are all sorts of weird stuff going on in Haggard's mind. There is also another woman called Fulata, who is a love interest in the book, and she's very pretty, but she's killed, and she is obsessed with one of the fellowship, who is Captain Good, who also spends a lot of time in the book walking around without his trousers on. I have no idea, but the other characters in the book are actually obsessed by his hugely muscular legs. And it's clear that she and Good are actually a couple. So when she dies, you know, Alan Quarterman says, you know, I consider her removal a fortunate occurrence because otherwise complications would have been sure to ensue. In other words, to his imperial readers, you can't shack up with African women. It will bring you bad luck. That's effectively what he's saying. But the complications in Haggard's mind, I think, are not just social. They're biological. Because keep in mind, guys, this is an age where racism is scientifically based. Yes, there was such a time and there was such a thing. And there is a lot of that in Rider Haggard's novels. So the masculine brotherhood and the idea of becoming, you know, I guess more true to yourself when you're out with your male mates in Africa, you know, hunting with them and dressing up with them and having adventures with them goes hand in hand with this idea that if you're actually at home in the city with all the modern trappings of modernity, that as a race, as a white race, you're actually becoming degenerate. And this is actually terminology that Haggard would definitely have used. And he certainly used it in his newspaper articles a little bit later on, that basically the white race is losing its vital sap and all that kind of thing. And this fear of racial degeneracy runs right through both his books. Well, actually right through all his books. And it's not just Haggard, as I mentioned. It's very, very much the culture of the 1880s, which I think is what makes it so incredibly interesting. So Britain goes to war, and every British defeat, and the defeat especially against the Zulus, the defeat in the First Boer War, they're all explained away by the fact of, well, what did you expect? You know, Haggard is basically saying, what did you expect? You know, these soldiers all worked in the cities and they worked in the factories, and they've become racially inferior, or to use Haggard's word, degenerate. And this is the character who epitomizes this, the woman character. It's the person from Haggard's other massive bestseller, She. And that's another, and of course, that's another epic quest. And I don't have the time to run through that book as well. But the lead character of She, just in case you haven't read it, is a combination of Gugul and Fulata. And she's basically very beautiful, but thousands of years old. And she maintains the secret of eternal youth. But she's also an incredible witch, an incredible sorceress, and her name is Aisha. And look, I would have to say that she is definitely one of the most dominating female characters, I think, in all of fiction for all of time. And of course, that's also the name that was given to Rider Haggard's doll, She Who Must Be Obeyed. And actually, in the Rumpole of the Bailey British television series, a fantastic series, by the way, that was shown, I think, back in the 1980s, Rumpole there actually calls his wife She Who Must Be Obeyed. And as I said, I think we've heard it in numerous books and movies and television series since. So if you read She, it's an absolutely intoxicating book. It's actually hard not to read it without your Freudian hat on, though. You know, she has these incredibly long monologues throughout, and she rants on a bit like Donald Trump, and I think has only one point to make, that being that men are powerless in the face of a beautiful woman. Who would argue that point? But women desire not men, but power. The greatest woman to have ever lived is a disappointment. You know, she, in many ways, she's a heckling kind of sexy witch. And, you know, the characters in the book are forced to listen to Aisha, you know, all the time. As I said, she has these massive monologues. But in the end, there is this kind of degenerative stuff, because she bathes in the fountain of life and she shrivels, you know, in the flames, and in Haggard's words, you know, turns into a little ancient monkey, you know, before she dies. So this, again, there are all sorts of things that are going on with the, you know, I think with the undercurrents of, I don't know, I guess, imperial mentality, I suppose. But look, if truth be told, she is the primary text of the Lost World genre. You can't argue that fact. You know, Brian Aldiss actually wrote the history of science fiction. And it's kind of a definitive chronicle of science fiction. And he says of she creates this idea of the empress, the priestess, and the sorceress, who is at the heart of so many scientific romances. And of course, we all know that in these early novels and early scientific films, you know, where man lands on an alien planet, they're usually ruled by these terrifyingly sexy, but, you know, deeply evil women. I mean, that is pure Rider Haggard. I mean, going even deeper into the subconscious, is there a sense that Rider Haggard is expressing something in the fact that She, which was published in 1887, and bear with me on this, which is the year of Queen Victoria's Jubilee. I'm just wondering whether Aisha, I'm thinking about this now, is Aisha is actually effectively a reclusive white queen ruling over Africans, and so is Queen Victoria. I mean, I actually have no idea if this is what Haggard is actually thinking. But I've read it. Lots of critics have actually said this, you know, that this post-colonial critics have actually said that he cites his own anxieties, you know, or it's actually a reflection of Great Britain's anxieties about its own empire, about its own legitimacy. But look, I'm a skeptic on most things, and I think all of this could be a coincidence. But the other part of me is saying that it actually could be because, you know, because of Victoria. And even if he's not consciously doing it to make this villain, you know, the white queen, Aisha, I don't know. I mean, in the book, Aisha says, she actually says this, "I'm going to go back to Britain with you. I'm going to topple your queen who is useless and become queen myself." I'm just saying, you know, it's possible. And I think there are a few other themes that are worth mentioning too. Obviously, these are books from an age of exploration. So, you know, Burton and Speke, you know, Richard Burton and John Hanning Speke, you know, a couple of decades earlier had actually gone on some amazing expeditions to discover, you know, the African Great Lakes, you know, in the heart of Africa. Henry Morton Stanley had found Livingstone in 1872, and his book on Livingstone had actually been a massive, massive hit as well. And it's this fascination that you get with maps in She and in King Solomon's Mines. I mean, that's absolutely of the age, and people love this idea. I mean, Joseph Conrad actually talks later on in Hearts of Darkness, also a fantastic movie. I mean, there are two ideas. One is that Africa is the heart of darkness, and that by going deeper into Africa, you penetrate into the world of primeval wickedness. That's worth thinking about. I mean, that's a very, very common thought, a very popular thought about Africa in the 19th century, you know, stopping slavery and witchcraft and you know, all of the above. And also the idea about blank spaces. And there are blank spaces on the map at this stage when Haggard is writing this book. And who knows? Who knows what's there? And there is that tension. So if Africa is this land where savagery is expressed, you know, through slavery and witchcraft, it's also a land where lost wisdom may be found, you know, kind of a primal freshness that the warriors are braver and stronger and fiercer. So, I mean, there is a kind of tension there that is, I suppose if you're writing novels, it results not just in the writing of racist propaganda. There clearly is an immense enthusiasm for the British Empire in Rider Haggard's books. That goes without question. And of course, by today's standards, there is a deep stain of racism in those books. But it's not just racist. It's not just imperial. But it reaps narrative fruit from those tensions. You know, Haggard actually regards the character of Ignosi in King Solomon's Mines as noble, as impressive. And actually, at the end of the book, spoiler alert, he, of course, regains his kingdom. But he expressly says to the hero, to Allan Quatermain, "No other white men may come into my kingdom. I know all you want is diamonds and gold, but we won't have you. We won't have missionaries selling rum, you know, and all that kind of stuff." And that shows that Haggard is actually aware of the costs of empire and what an African king would actually say about it had he been given the chance. So, guys, more spoilers for you. Ignosi gets his kingdom. Sir Henry Curtis does find his brother. But actually, the quest for King Solomon's Mines actually turns out to be a dud because many of the characters are actually not interested in the diamonds at all. You know, Allan Quatermain is, however, you know, he actually scoops up lots of them. and ends up very rich and is very unhappy by it. You know, he actually goes back to England, much like Haggard, and buys a massive estate and is very restless and unhappy. So Henry Curtis doesn't take any diamonds at all. And any other Europeans who, you know, Haggard kind of comes across in the novel actually gets a lot of criticism. You know, the fascinating thing for me about Haggard and so many of these imperial writers, Kipling, I think, is also very similar, is that he is too good a writer just to be a racist propagandist. And that's important. When he's not writing novels that sell faster than hotcakes at the baker's, he's incredibly jingoistic. You know, he writes copious letters to the Times. And I think the date here is probably around 1913, you know, saying that the future of Africa will never be a conflict between the British and the Boers. And that's interesting because remember, the Boer War ended in 1901. But the inevitable far-off struggle for practical supremacy will be between the whites and the blacks. And of course, if you think about apartheid and everything else that's taken place in almost every African nation after they split Africa up, what he says actually came to fruition and was very true. In actual fact, in 1924, some 11 years after that fact, in his diary, he actually says, "The great penultimate war will be between the white and colored races, and that history will ultimately be the bloody story of these opposed races." But look, I suppose the tension there that he isn't taking for granted who would actually win that war. And that's what really interests me about that statement. He doesn't say. And I think it's because his view, as it has been all the way through, is that the white race is degenerate and that the black race is braver and stronger and far less corrupted. And of course, he talks again and again, and other writers do as well, about how life is a struggle. You know, he's a classic Darwinist, you know, a social Darwinist, if truth be told. So he gives these words to Aisha and she, "None but the strongest can endure. Those who are weak must perish. The earth is to the strong and the fruits thereof. For every tree that grows, a score shall wither, so that the strong may take their share." I mean, that's like something that the Nazi Party would have said in the 1930s. But it's absolutely what the general populace was saying and thinking in the 1920s. You know, he's obsessed that in Britain, people have lost their manliness. And actually, the heroes that he likes are not generally imperialistic. They are big game hunters and explorers. You know, he's of that generation that fantasize about these mavericks, these virile, you know, kind of eccentric characters. And I think there's only really one model for Allan Quatermain that Haggard would have based that character on. So Quatermain actually says at the beginning of King Solomon's Mines, "I've been trading, hunting, fighting, and mining all my life," which is incredibly Wilbur Smith, by the way. But the real life inspiration for Quatermain, I think, is rather interesting. And that guy, I think, is Frederick Selous, who was a British explorer, officer, a professional hunter and a conservationist who was actually famous for his exploits in Southeast Africa. Selous arrived in Africa aged 19 and ended up working for Cecil Rhodes. He shot 78 elephants in 3 years. And the Natural History Museum in London to this day actually has 524 animals in their collection that were shot by Selous, including 19 lions. Different times, folks, not for us to judge. But Selous actually excelled in cricket, rugby, cycling, swimming, tennis. He loved the outdoors, developing a robust physique, you know, by trekking, packing, and marching and hunting. He was a tall man. He had the most incredible eyes. And I guess if you were to, it's difficult for me to explain because I'm looking at a picture of him as I talk. And I think the best way to describe him is Robert Redford's character in From Out of Africa. That's who he looks like. He was also an accomplished rider, and he waged war and hunted much on horses. You know, to the African locals, he was actually known as the best white runner. He was an incredible endurance athlete, you know, an aspect which is not dissimilar to the native Bushman's, you know, concept. And, you know, while in England, while he was there, he played, and when he went back, he played all sorts of sports right up until he was, you know, in his late 60s, even then riding a 100-mile bike race. Incredible specimen of a man. So I think he was absolutely the inspiration for Haggard's Alan Quatermain. I'm convinced of it. And also for quite a lot of the Wilbur Smith characters that came about almost 100 years later. And I'll just read you this. I love this description of him, which was actually written by a Captain R.M. Haynes in 1917. If there was one striking feature in his physiology, it was his wonderful eyes, as clear and as blue as the summer sea. Nearly everyone who came in contact with him noticed his eyes. They were the eyes of the man who looks into the beyond vast spaces. Instinctively, one saw in them the hunter and the man of wide views. In social intercourse, Sellers had a presence that was apt to make other people look insignificant. He was adored by all his friends, and even perfect strangers seemed to come under his magnetism at the first introduction. So that's quite the description. That's who I think Alan Quatermain was based on. And look, I don't think there's enough about him to create another podcast on its own, but I will do some research into it because he is an intriguing character. So back to Haggard. Look, all of these things about hunting and people simultaneously, you know, admiring and fearing the native peoples that they are displacing and you know, kind of ripping off, you know, that sense of a frontier that is slowly closing. And of course, you know, what that reminds me of is the Wild West in America. And the role that that has actually played in the American kind of cultural imagination. And there's actually a sense that Africa is playing that role for British writers. You know, the idea of hunting, the idea of, you know, of Indians in America, you know, native Indians in America, that they are to be feared and also respected. And of course, the legacy of the Wild West continues all the way into the future. And everybody's actually familiar with that. I guess the influence of King Solomon's Mines and that tradition remains an important part of popular culture today, I think. So, look, when Haggard dies in 1925, the Edinburgh Review actually printed this. Haggard's South African romances filled many a young fellow with the longing to go into the wide spaces of those lands and see those marvels for himself, and have thus aided far more than we can ever know in bringing British settlers and influence into the new country. They have helped to establish the dreams and aims of Mr. Cecil Rhodes. So look, a few things on that. Obviously, Haggard is one of the great writers of empire, as I said before, very much like Kipling. But I also think the themes that I've just mentioned, like, you know, the Wild West and also the idea of being stuck underground, archaeological discoveries, lost worlds, you know, layers and layers of history that adventurers are uncovering, you know, terrifying sorceresses. I mean, they're all the way through, aren't they? Partly because even at the end of Haggard's life, his works, you know, they were then being adapted for screen. So, you know, all of these people who were working in Hollywood, you know, even if they'd never read King Solomon's Mines or She, all of these people who were at work in the cinema or later, you know, in TV, you know, they're intimately familiar with the themes of Haggard's novels. And that's why I think you see them again and again in popular culture, you know, running all the way through to now. And even after Britain's involvement in Africa Changed, which was, of course, just after, you know, the Second World War. We see Haggard in Indiana Jones, and I mentioned some of the computer games at the beginning of this podcast. So I think that in the last few decades, I think there's been some massive reworking of King Solomon's Mines, which have had an even bigger global impact. And I think the first and most important of that is the novelist Wilbur Smith. Look, I'm a massive fan, and I had an absolutely lovely conversation with Charles Muscat not that long ago, who is a gentleman in his late 70s, who is also a massive Wilbur Smith fan. And what I loved about that entire conversation, Charles, if you're listening, is that Smith spans the generations. Smith is the biggest African selling novelist of all time, hands down. And he's actually from Rhodesia. You know, he was born there. He grew up in Africa and spent all his life in Rhodesia. And Rhodesia is the place where the great ruins of Zimbabwe were. And of course, in due course, white rule gets toppled and the country itself actually comes to be called Zimbabwe. And Grey Zimbabwe, which is of course, one of the inspirations for King Solomon Mines. Well, in 1941, a very young Wilbur Smith, aged 8 years old, he actually went on a nighttime expedition with his dad to go and see the ruins of Great Zimbabwe. And those ruins stuck in his mind because decades later, he wrote all these incredibly best-selling books where lost African cities actually played a really important part. And they are novels that are haunted by, I think they're haunted by regret, you know, the collapse of the British Empire. So in that sense now, of course, it's a very unfashionable perspective. But the success of Smith as a writer, I think, tell you a great deal about how the British people and the Commonwealth feel about that particular legacy. And of course, look, they appeal to a particular reader. As I said, I'm a massive fan. I've read everything that Smith ever produced many, many times. So I like books with some punch and prose. I have to say. But the other thing that I think about the reworking of these themes and the traditions of King Solomon's Mines is perhaps a more unexpected one that comes from the American perspective. And that is the massive hit Black Panther. So Black Panther is actually part of the Marvel franchise, you know, part of the MCU. You know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And of course, the start of it is about a lost city in Africa. And just as Rider Haggard says, you know, that these great works from these great civilizations derive from the Venetians, so in Black Panther, you know, the almost supernatural power that the people of Wakanda, I think is the city there, is derived from some weird metal, I think it's called vibranium, that the hero also swallows. So where I'm going with this, folks, is what the Venetians are to King Solomon's Mines, vibranium is to, you know, Black Panther, i.e. something that explains how a civilization has survived in the middle of Africa. Look, I don't actually like the film because of vibranium, because I don't think you need it. You have this ancient civilization, you have a lost city that is veiled by, you know, this high-tech screen, a paradisical land, you know, all the stuff that you get in King Solomon's Mines. So you have this sense that the warriors there, and of course there are female warriors as well, which I absolutely love, they're stronger, they're harder, they're tougher, they're cooler than you would get in the West. They even have combat between, you know, rival contenders, which is very much a theme of King Solomon's Mines. And I think even the name, you know, Black Panther is a reflection of the radical policies of America that kind of were fostered in from 1960s onwards. It's absolutely indubitably to be informed by the expected legacy of King Solomon's Mines. And to find it there really unexpectedly surprised me, more so than in the novels of the great Wilbur Smith. I wonder if you would agree, Mr. Musket, if you are listening. And of course, that bears the point. And I've talked about the pop culture of, let's say, you know, 1870 to the 1930s. You know, it establishes the template for so many things that we take for granted today. You know, anybody who plays a video game will absolutely have played an iteration of She or King Solomon's Mines. It's actually extraordinary to think of how many popular cultural themes and devices that we're all familiar with that date from those years, you know, either side of the 20th century, and actually from British imperial pop culture. Okay, so I've been talking so long about Wilbur Smith and all these amazing things that it's probably about time to bring this podcast to an end. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is H. Rider Haggard. And I will be returning next week, hopefully, if my voice holds out and I'm not traveling, with Lawrence of Arabia, who I think would have absolutely loved all this stuff. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll look forward to chatting to you next week. Bye for now.